Hello and welcome to Pythagorean Astronomy. I'm Chris North, and what you're about to listen to was originally broadcast as part of Pythagoras' Trousers, a science and engineering show on Radio Cardiff. You can find a full show and listen to past episodes at pythagorastrousers.co.uk. But for now, here's this month's astronomy. Well, the biggest bit of space-related news this month was probably the fact that Philae, the lander that bounced onto the surface of comet 67P Churyumov-Gerasimenko last November, has awoken and is talking with Earth again. All being well, it should continue to do great science as the comet makes its closest approach to the Sun in August this year, and we'll follow that story. But this month, I'd like to look a little closer to home with some interesting atmospheric discoveries from the world of radio astronomy. Specifically, a result from the radio telescope based in Australia called the Murchison Wide Field Array. Joining me now is Dr. Natasha Hurley-Walker from the International Centre for Radio Astronomy Research. Welcome to the programme, Natasha.
Hi, Chris. Thanks very much.
I guess we'd better start with a description of the radio telescope you're using.
Sure. So it's the Murchison Wide Field Array. It's actually a precursor to the Square Kilometre Array, which some of your listeners might have heard of. It operates at quite a low frequency, actually pretty similar to the frequency that this broadcast would go out on if it's going out on real radio. It's sort of in the FM band, so around 80 to 200 megahertz. And it consists of about 128 sort of tile-shaped antennas. They look a little bit like spiders crawling across the desert. And they're separated across a distance of about 3 kilometers. So we have 128 of these. This is a very large number for a radio telescope. Typically, a radio telescope will have something like 8 to 10 antennas, perhaps as many as 20. But we have this very, very filled array with lots and lots of receivers. They're not particularly sensitive in and of themselves, but when we combine the signals together, we can get a very beautiful picture of the low-frequency radio sky.
So the number of receivers means that you can, as you say, the sensitivity of the whole thing gets a lot better, but then the size, the maximum distance between the individual antennas means that you can see very, very small-scale things up on the sky, so very fine detail.
Yes, reasonably fine detail for this frequency. So as you go to a higher frequency, you get better resolution. And indeed, as you separate the antenna elements, you also get better resolution. But there's an issue with doing that at low frequencies. And the issue is that we have an intervening ionosphere around the Earth. And this can distort the radio signals, particularly badly at low frequencies. And that also becomes more difficult as we separate the antennas more. They tend to see different parts of the ionosphere. This makes those sort of observations very difficult. The MWA has taken a sort of conservative approach to start with, where we have everything in this fairly compact core within 3 kilometres. And then we're not too affected by the ionosphere on a typical observing night. If you're interested in other low-frequency radio telescopes, there's the low-frequency array, which is distributed across the Netherlands and the UK and a few other European countries. And they have baselines of hundreds of kilometres, and they are extremely sensitive to ionospheric disturbance. They have incredible resolution, but the computational cost of processing their data is very large.
This is a region of the Earth's atmosphere that's a few hundred kilometres high above the surface. What in the ionosphere causes the disturbances that you see?
So the ionosphere, I guess the clue is in the name, is ionized. So it has free electrons in it. And electromagnetic radiation that it goes incident through an ionized plasma is distorted by that plasma. And we're using an interferometer here. So this is fairly complicated, but when you have an incident wavefront that comes through an ionized plasma, there's a sort of total number of electrons that the wavefront is moving through. And if that wavefront just moves through a sort of simple number of electrons, like every part of the wavefront is distorted equally, an interferometer, where it's combining the signals from several different antennas, can't actually see those electrons. All of the wavefront is distorted in the same way. But if there is a gradient in the electron field, if there are overdensities and underdensities of the electrons in the ionosphere, then the waves are distorted differently. And those can be picked up by a radio telescope. So in effect, what we see is instead of nice, simple radio sources dotted around the sky and just simply sitting there, we see them twinkling. We see them moving. It's as if you're observing the sky from the bottom of a swimming pool which does make it rather difficult sometimes.
So a constantly changing view of the sky, but you found a way of figuring out what those changes are to be able to map out this ionosphere.
Yes, indeed. So typically, on a sort of normal observing night, we have, as the sun sets, the terminator line, which you can see if you go out in the sunset and you see the sky go from light to dark, and there's kind of this distinct line. That causes a lot of ionospheric disturbance. Basically, the ionosphere is going from this very turbulent, very busy, you know, it's being impacted and warmed and changed by the sun all day, to kind of a quiescent state overnight. And that causes this big gradient to move across our observations. So we're sort of used to that. We know that that happens. We'd taken quite a lot of observing nights where we'd seen this happen. And that's fine. You know, we're used to that. We'd also noticed a little bit of correlation with solar activity. So sometimes when the sun becomes a little bit more active, it distorts the Earth's magnetic field, which distorts the ionosphere, which therefore distorts our observations. But on one night, I was actually just doing some routine calibration checks. I'm trying to carefully measure the sensitivity of the instrument. And I was getting ridiculous numbers, just completely absurd. I was seeing these sources, they are moving way too much, far more than could be explained by the terminator. That sounds disturbing. Or just the normal solar activity. And when I imaged the radio sources, I noticed they were moving from left to right. They were sort of oscillating back and forth, as if they were being distorted by waves. And this was quite strange because we didn't really expect to see any big coherent structures in the ionosphere. If something is moving back and forth, then there must be something coherent that's moving that source. And what we realized eventually, and actually this is work done by an undergraduate in Sydney University, what we realized is that the astronomical sky was rotating, and it was rotating past a series of fixed waves on the sky. So the sources appeared to be moving left to right because they were moving past an overdensity and then an underdensity and then an overdensity and then an underdensity, and it was shifting the apparent positions left and right from where we expected them to be. And what was really, really cool about this observation was that the shifts, the sort of lines along which these things seem to be moving, were perfectly aligned with the Earth's magnetic field.
The Earth's magnetic field, you can think of it as being like the field of a bar magnet with a north pole and a south pole. And obviously down in Australia, you're nearer the south pole than the north pole. But you see these lines, like people might have done experiments in school with iron filings tracing the field lines from a bar magnet. And you expect to see a pattern like that in the Earth's magnetic field. But we don't have any iron filings up in space. You've essentially observed the effect of these, well, not iron filings, but these electrons that are doing the same kind of job. Is that a nice analogy?
Yeah, that's a good analogy. So what tends to happen, and we're still, the physics behind this is still being worked out, but what tends to happen is sometimes the Earth's ionosphere and plasmasphere interact, and they create these big tubes, which are called Whistler ducts. And they seem to be, indeed, completely aligned with the Earth's magnetic field. And actually, people have known about these things since about the 50s and 60s, because what they'd notice is that there would be a big lightning storm somewhere in the northern hemisphere. And in the southern hemisphere, around the same opposite point on the Earth's magnetic field, you'd pick up a lot of low-frequency radio static. And it was clear that the signals from the lightning storm were being transmitted all the way from one hemisphere to another. Now, that was kind of strange. You know, they tried all sorts of propagation techniques to work out how this could possibly happen. And eventually they theorized that there must be these plasmaspheric ducts, these Whistler ducts. They take the Whistlers from the lightning all the way from one part of the Earth's magnetic field to another. But no one could really prove that these things existed other than just by inferring their presence. So the amazing thing was, when we did these observations and we saw these magnetic field lines, we realized we were imaging something that literally nobody had ever seen directly before and had only theorized that had existed. So it was utterly fantastic. And we could even see that they were evolving with time, changing in altitude. And, well, this is a beautiful bit of imaging from, an idea from Clio. I did the imaging, but, you know, it was a team effort. It was fantastic. She had the brilliant idea of splitting the Murchison Whitefield array into two halves, into two eyes, if you will. So there's an east side of the array and a west side of the array. And we just imaged using one half of it and imaged using the other half of it. And then you can see the difference in the source positions from one side of the array to the other. Mm. It's the effect of parallax. So we just did that, and we could see that the ducts are actually at a particular altitude, and it's that interaction layer between the ionosphere and the plasmasphere. So it's exactly where people predicted it would be. So it's a beautiful piece of theory meeting real data, and I guess we just never expected to see it. So it was really brilliant.
The whistlers, I mean, I've heard of them before. So these are phenomena that you hear, as you say, associated with lightning storms. And because they're in the FM part of the spectrum, the same spectrum for radio waves, you can sort of tune into them. So I believe there's audio files that let you play what these sound like if you could tune into them with a radio telescope. We can hear some recordings of whistlers caused by lightning now from Stephen McGreevy. Since lightning occurs on other planets, we can tune into those whistlers as well. The Voyager spacecraft picked up these whistlers caused by lightning in Jupiter's atmospheres as it flew past in the late 1970s. They can be heard faintly in this audio, just above the hiss, courtesy of the University of Iowa.
And that's very cool. I didn't know that people were doing that. So that's really cool.
Splitting the array into two gives you this stereo vision, if you like, which lets you measure the distances. And you mentioned that was the idea of Clio. Clio is a student who was working on this with you. So you were helped greatly by this by students studying at the university.
Yeah, so the MWA is a big international project, and there's a lot of different people working on the data. We also produce a tremendous volume of data. So we do have quite a lot of students involved at many different universities. And Clio's original project was looking at transient astronomical radio phenomena. And then she realized that in order to do this well, she would need to characterize certain instrumental systematics. So I was looking at a data set to kind of help with that. And then I found this ionospheric effect. And I was thinking, well, I don't really know what to do with this. I don't have time. But Clio's interested in transients, and she's interested in the ionosphere. So she said, oh, no, I'll have a look. You know, but I'll just see what happens. Maybe it'll affect the way we look at astronomical transients. And it went from there. You know, she properly analyzed the data and really thought about what does this mean? You know, what could this be? What could be happening physically? We also consulted a huge range of ionospheric experts from all around the world, each of whom had their pet theory about what it could be. And eventually, it was a chap from the US suggested these whistler ducts, but said, oh, well, you can't prove it unless you can tell what altitude they are. Until Clio figured, well, hang on a minute, we can do stereo vision. We can tell the altitude, and pinned it down. So, yeah, fantastic.
So that's a result of an astronomical telescope looking at something, say, 600 kilometres above the surface at this top of the ionosphere. But astronomical telescopes also care about things that are much closer. You mentioned that you're looking in the FM band, this radio band. So you must care about radio stations down on Earth that presumably are emitting at similar frequencies. How do you get around those problems?
The easiest thing to do is to build your radio telescope in an area where there aren't any radio transmitters. So that's the approach that the MWA has taken. And indeed, it's built on the same site that we hope to build the low frequency a component of the square kilometer array. So it is literally in the middle of nowhere. And I've been up there a couple of times. I helped commission it. And you take a flight or you drive for 10 hours. The flight's 2 hours, the drive is 10 hours. Then you stay overnight, and then you drive for a further 3 hours. Or you could take a tiny plane, but I've never been offered. I always had to drive. And then you're in the Murchison Radio Quiet Zone, which is set up by the Australian government as a radio astronomy area, which is deliberately free of all sorts of TV transmitters and radio transmitters. You can't have your phone, you can't have Wi-Fi. It's all completely radio quiet. And once you get there, you know, you have a satellite phone for emergencies, but that's it. Other than that, you're completely cut off. But of course, we've buried a huge amount of fiber optic cable now, so the internet up there is actually probably better than it is at my home. And yeah, it's really brilliant. And so mostly we don't actually see any radio frequency interference, or RFI, as we tend to call it. Occasionally, of course, just as the these plasma ducts can conduct lightning effects, we do get ionospheric conditions which reflect radio emissions from distant transmitters over the array. And so occasionally we'll just see a sort of a burst of RFI as it's reflected by a sort of refractive wave in the ionosphere. The other really cool thing that reflects radio waves at us are man-made objects and anything that's orbiting the Earth. So there's a very cool little experiment that another student did at the Australian National University. I think he's moved to the University of Melbourne now, and that's Ben McKinley. He did this really great experiment where he looked at the moon, and he looked at the moon in the FM band, and found that basically between 80 and 100 megahertz, where all our radio stations are emitting, he could see all of the reflected radio waves from the moon. And he did this really lovely little calculation where he worked out the total power of all of our radio stations, and then sort of said, well, okay, who would be able to hear us, and worked out how loud the radio stations would have to be on Alpha Centauri for us to hear them. So that was a pretty, that was a nice little result. It was very sweet. And also we can reflect it off, as I say, like man-made satellites. So we did pick up this very strange sort of moving object in one of our observations. And eventually we realized it's the International Space Station reflecting Heart FM.
Right.
So I think there's a Heart FM in every country, and it's always
dreadful. I think
there
must be now, yeah.
Oh, sorry, other radio stations are available. And yeah, so we could watch the ISS track by in reflected RFI. So mostly it's not a problem. But occasionally it's very cool.
There was a really fun story that came out of another institute in Australia, the Parkes Radio Telescope, which was looking at radio waves that were thought to maybe be astronomical, but the solution ended up being something much, much closer to home and involving microwaves. So tell us a little bit about this story. I know it's not something you worked on, but it was in the same country, so I'll count that as a win. Tell us a little bit about these microwave radio waves.
Okay, so the story actually kind of starts in 2007 with a British astronomer, Duncan Lorimer, who observed a very, very bright burst of radiation called the Lorimer burst, which appeared to be extragalactic, extremely bright, ridiculously bright, so bright that it saturated the receiver of the telescope that he was looking at, so nobody could actually tell how bright it was. And this thing seemed to be extragalactic and very, very bright, very strange, because, you know, if something is extragalactic, it must have come from very far away, but how could something so far away be so bright? So it was sort of a strange puzzle, and nobody ever saw one again. So this Lorimer burst kind of, you know, entered the imagination. Nobody really knew how to characterize a one-off event.
I'm sure there are wild and wonderful theories about it.
Oh, so many theories. Theorists love a single data point. The worst thing you can do is give them more data points, because, you know, then it gets rid of so many beautiful theories. Anyway, so we were, obviously astronomers were kind of looking out for these things, maybe hoping to see another one. And one day at the Parkes Radio Telescope, they did see some other things that looked kind of like the Lorimer burst. Now, the Lorimer burst has a very particular spectral signature. It also has what's called a dispersion measure. So it appears to have been dispersed by an ionized plasma, which we, given the way that the signal looks, it seems to have come from a very, very long way away through a very great intervening ionized plasma. But then we were seeing these little signals. Well, we weren't. Other astronomers were seeing these signals, which kind of looked a bit like they'd come through some ionized plasma, but if so, not very much. It didn't really match up with the Lorimer burst. They had a slightly different spectrum. They also didn't seem to be bright across all frequencies. They seemed to sort of shift. They seemed to have harmonics. They were just particularly at certain frequencies. So it wasn't quite right, but it was a bit of a puzzle because, of course, if the Lorimer burst isn't extragalactic, what could it be? Are these things like the Lorimer burst? So this really big puzzle. No one was really sure what was going on. Anyway, again, another fantastic student, Emily Petrov, she started turning her attention to these things, and she recorded a bunch of them, and she called them peritons. And it was sort of postulated that they were atmospheric phenomena. Perhaps they were lightning or something along those lines. But she kept working on it. She was like, I'm not going to let this go. They're either extragalactic and they're associated with the Lorimer burst and other objects like that, or they're atmospheric or man-made. I'm going to find out what's causing them. And one day, beautiful piece of detective work, she noticed that at the same time that one of these peritons would go off, somebody in the park's tea room would be heating their lunch.
Ah.
And it was noticed that there was a sort of cadence to these things. They were happening around mealtimes, and they were happening at certain times of year and not at other times of year. And eventually, they tracked it down to a microwave oven. There's a particular microwave oven that if you didn't let the timer fully go, so, you know, when it makes that awful beeping noise and tells you your food is definitely done, if you open the door beforehand, little burst of electromagnetic radiation comes out, and the Parkes telescope, even if it's not pointed, you know, anywhere near it, picks that up. And that was coming out as one of these peritons, one of these little bursts, which was, yeah, very embarrassing for all the astronomers concerned. But it was very good because it was clear that these things were not like the Lorimer burst. These things are, you can do it. They're now replicable. So you can go and you can open the microwave and you can generate a periton. And it's clear that the spectral signature is very different from the Lorimer burst. And so, you know, we now know that they're not the same thing. And Emily's got a lot of a good recognition for doing this work, because it takes some detective work to correlate your data with people having their lunch, you know, checking literally every possible correlation.
Well, we're used to in astronomy of not being able to control the experiment because it's things happening light years away or millions of light years away, and you can't go and change things. But of course, changing people having their lunch is probably as difficult. Trying to persuade them not to use a microwave or to use a microwave at a specific moment is not very controllable either. So yeah, as you say, brilliant detective work, and another fun story of how radio telescopes can look very far and also very near at the same time.
Indeed.
Well, Natasha Hurley-Wilcott, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks very much, Chris. It was great to have the opportunity to talk about this research.
Time now to look at what's in the sky this month, so joined again by Hugh Lang.
Hello, Chris.
The start of July, the Earth's pretty much at its furthest point from the Sun.
That is true, but of course, bear in mind the Earth's orbit's fairly circular, so it doesn't make a great difference. So what really gives us the warm weather is the angle of which the Sun is actually tilted over.
Sticking in the neighbourhood, we get two full moons, called a blue moon.
That's correct. It's not really blue, it just happens we get two full moons in the month, the first one being on the 2nd and the second full moon being on the 31st. Fairly rare. What happened to January 31st, 2018?
Yeah, here's once in a blue moon, of course.
Yes.
At the start of the month, we're going to find Venus and Jupiter, which have been around for a while now, fading into the evening twilight.
That's right. They are getting closer to the horizon with the Sun, but they actually, Jupiter and Venus, are actually getting closer to themselves as well. So they look like two brilliant points of light. The best time to look for those will be about 30 minutes after sunset, roughly on the 18th, if you look around then. Be the best time.
And there's a moon next to them then on the 18th as well.
That's right.
Mars and Mercury, not very easy to observe. They're up in the morning, but again in the twilight.
That's right. You have to be up 4:30 in the morning to spot those. They'd be very close northern, eastern horizon and low, so difficult to see.
Moving further out, Saturn's been around for a few months now, starting to fade. It never gets that high, but worth looking at.
That's right, best object for the early evening observers, some 18 degrees above the horizon. However, with a small telescope, the rings are open at about 24 degrees, so it will make a good view, worth looking at. And of course, if you look at the end of the month, look to the east side of Saturn, 25th, 26th of the month, spot Titan.
And of course, the Cassini spacecraft currently orbiting Saturn, so you won't see the spacecraft itself, but you will know it's there when you're looking through your telescope or binoculars. And speaking of spacecraft, topical very much, the New Horizons spacecraft whizzing past Pluto on the 14th of July. So Pluto's actually quite convenient to locate if you've
That's
got
right.
a big enough telescope.
Pluto's at opposition on the 6th of July. You'll need a 12-inch or so telescope to see it, but worth looking for if you've got that sort of telescope, which will look no more than a star. Really, you'll have to look over a couple of nights to actually see it move against the background of stars.
Sticking with dwarf planets and spacecraft, NASA's spacecraft Dawn is orbiting Ceres, which is also easily observable, and this time in binoculars.
Much brighter. Well, 7.40 binoculars will be fine, but again, it's going to be like Pluto. You're going to have to watch it for a couple of nights and watch the background stars and see the relative displacement.
But Ceres and Pluto, probably for experienced observers.
Take a bit of doing, than, yeah. Yes.
And lastly, possibly a bright evening comet at the start of the month.
Right, C/2014 Pan-STARRS. Hopefully this is going to turn into a nice comet. Reaches perihelion on the 6th, that is close to the sun, on the 6th of July. It will be tricky to locate because it's going to be close to the horizon. The best time to look would be about 10:30, so not too late. But you will need a flat northeast horizon. The other way to look at it, by the 12th of the month, it'd be close to Castor. On the 8th, close to Pollux. Best way to look for it is try to locate Venus and Jupiter after sunset. Again, close and low to the northwest horizon. And with a pair of binoculars, scan to the right. Just be towards Castor and Pollux, and hopefully you'll sweep through the comet.
Comets are always unpredictable, but possibly something nice to look out for.
And it might get brighter, so it might be easier to see.
Who can say?
Yes.
We'll find out next month. So until then, Hugh, thanks very much.
Thank you, Chris.
You've been listening to Pythagorean Astronomy with me, Chris North. It was originally broadcast on Radio Cardiff as part of Pythagoras' Trousers.